My name is Ann Smith, and I'm a volunteer with the Sam Proctor Oral History Program. And today's date is March 28th, 2011. And this is for the World War II collection. I'm at the home of Philip Speer. And this interview is to augment and fill in documents that he has already written in chronologic detail for our archives, so not all of the stories will necessarily be complete, but we'll start at the beginning. And give me your full name, if you would, please, Bill.
I use Philip J. Speer, Jr., Senior.
Okay.
Because I do have a junior.
Okay. And there's no funny spelling about it. It's just as it.
And Philip with one L.
Okay.
The way my mother put it down, whether it was in the Bible or a lover of horses, I'm not sure.
You're not sure. Does the J stand for something?
James.
James. Okay. And where were you born?
I was born in Springfield, Massachusetts. The family lived in a suburban area, Chicopee Falls.
Mm-hmm.
But the hospital was Mercy Hospital in Springfield.
And what year was that?
That was 1914.
Okay. But you were born in a hospital.
I was indeed.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, were you the firstborn?
I think not. I think there were two previous births, or at least pregnancies, and at least one previous birth. So I was precious as a baby.
I guess so.
And sheltered for a long time. Because I was the only one.
You were special.
Yes.
Yes.
And that was made tenuous by whooping cough before I was a year old.
Oh, my goodness. Oh.
Barely survived, apparently.
Oh.
And in 1918.
Yeah.
Then there was the flu epidemic. My family doctor died.
No.
And so surviving that was another.
Was real
small,
tricky.
Small miracle.
Did anyone in the family get the flu?
I don't remember.
Sure.
Not part of the family lore.
Yeah. I understand. Those were scary times. And so how would you characterize your real early years?
My early years were carefully monitored. I was sheltered. Not really healthy. I went to first grade, but did poorly enough. I don't know the details, but the school and my mother agreed that I'd be better off staying home and securing my health than being in school. Apparently it was keeping up with the classes.
I see. Do you remember playmates in the neighborhood?
My neighborhood was 3/4 mile away.
I see.
So I had essentially no playmates. Children of my age that I knew at school would come to my home, which was a farm.
Mm-hmm.
And use it as there's a playground on Saturdays or some special days. Jump in the hay or play in the muddy brook. But so far as getting attachments to another child or more, that really didn't happen.
Right.
In school, I knew classmates.
And your father, did he was a farmer?
He became a farmer. He had been a postal delivery man. And had been so for a number of years, but he still didn't have enough time in for retirement when he stopped that work and became a farmer.
And did he grow crops or keep animals?
It was a general farm.
Gotcha.
A one-horse, side hill, general farm. So we had dairy cows, and one of the cash crops was cream, which was taken twice a week to the railroad station and shipped by little metal can to a creamery where it was made for butter, ice cream, and so forth. And that directed a little bit the type of animals that we had. So they were, they gave milk with good cream content. And we had a hand separator. You put the milk in one place and turn the crank, and cream came out one place and diluted milk in another. And that milk went for feeding calves and particularly pigs.
Did you help on the farm?
Oh, did I help?
You were the farmhand.
I was indeed. And I milked in the morning before I went to school and did whatever went along with it, and again in the evening, and that's 7 days a week.
Sure is.
I was able to get probably a day off now and then, but I don't remember. But I didn't replace my father at that time.
And your mother was busy as a farm wife?
As a farm wife, yes, but in an expanded role. Our home then, which had a number of rooms, I can't count at the moment, but I do recall that we had 17 guests spend a holiday night there. This would be in the 1920s.
Yes.
And people would do anything to have shelter. So there were people who slept on the floor somewhere, as well as in the beds in all the rooms we had. Amazing that it all happened with a small room that had been converted into a bathroom with a minimum equipment, and a second floor wonderful arrangement where there was a 2.5 by 2.5 room for a toilet and another one for a wash basin. So that's all there was for all those people. And they got along. But my mother was feeding them, cooking and feeding.
Just imagine.
Doing the laundry. and trying to be a hostess.
Yes.
As well. She was a remarkable, remarkably capable, hardworking woman.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
She was the brains of the family. My father was devoted, hardworking, but
yes.
he did the work.
Yeah, yeah. And you think they had a happy marriage?
Oh, yes, yes. I can recall as a youngster on Sunday afternoons, it was the custom to walk out in the fields, and I think there was some discussion of what crops were where and how
yes.
they were coming along and
yes.
and so forth. But my impression is of two lovers.
Yeah. Their time together.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, that's wonderful. That's great. What a wonderful tradition to yeah. have, you know, and say that's our time. Well, was religion a big part of your life as a child?
Yes, as a child, up to a point. My parents were devout Methodists.
Okay.
Excuse me. And until I was 12, I went to Sunday school
mm-hmm.
every Sunday and accumulated a great string of badges and bars.
Yes.
But I don't know if it fits in this story or not, but by the time I was 12, I was beginning to think a little bit. And attended, as I was expected to, a series of talks by the minister qualifying me to become a member of the
right.
of the church. Well, the church was a federated church. In this small town, there were not enough Protestants of any persuasion to carry it. So, and then descending order of population or preferences, Congregationalist, Methodist, and Baptist came together somehow to support
mm-hmm.
a minister. And I know there was occasionally a Congregational one and occasionally one from the Methodist. At any rate, there was kind of what appeared to me at the time to be an old footy-ditty Congregational minister gave this class for 12-year-olds. And when it came time to sign up for joining the church or acknowledging the creed that was used at the time,
mm-hmm.
I said, "Whoa, I'm not going to do that."
Nope.
Well, I think my parents would almost rather have seen me dead, but not really. But it was a terrible shock to them. And they didn't make much direct effort to persuade me, but they got the parent of two boys who had been in the class to talk to me. And I listened to him, and but about all he could say was it's the thing to do, and June or Bud are joining, you should go along with them. And I wasn't in a going along mood at that time.
12 years of age, that shows a lot of ego strength, I think.
Well, it developed it because I enjoyed the attention that I got.
I bet. I bet it caused a little stir.
Oh, it did. No, the town was almost predominantly Protestant.
Sure.
There was a Roman Catholic church there that I think had a visiting priest on weekends. So that was the town's orientation, and almost at once everybody knew about it and stood aghast at me. And you just didn't do those things in those days.
Little whippersnapper.
Yeah.
I'll be darned. You had described in the first material that you gave me something about having grown up as kind of a without the playmates and being somewhat of an introvert and thinking your own thoughts, and so coming out like that with something, you must have given it more thought than they had any idea.
Oh, indeed. Indeed. But I've classified it as a loner in one case, but in independence of thought.
Sure.
All came from being alone on the farm.
Of course.
And I had this farm, which was my whole playground, and I enjoyed every bit of it.
Sure.
And then I was a worker at it. But,
yes. But came to your own thoughts pretty independently, and I think that's remarkable. I think that's just remarkable. I love you getting attention for all of that. It caused quite a furor, didn't it?
Yes.
Well, did you?
But this was a town. The most recent census at the time gave it 702 or 10. People in the town.
Yeah. So you created quite a buzz.
Yes.
Well, were there any ramifications, or did it kind of die down after everybody got over the whiplash?
I don't remember any immediate, but jumping ahead. There was in college, looking for people to be with. There was a Christian Association, I think, was called at college, and that was also that. Or an associated affair was pacifist.
Mm-hmm.
So in the early 30s, I was involved there.
I see.
Setting aside that one of the things that attracted me most was a girl that was there.
I've heard stories like this before.
But I got enough in the pacifist thing that one weekend that I was home, I gave a sermon in the church.
Really?
On that subject, which gave my parents some assurance, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
They like to see me up there anyway.
Yeah. Well, did you graduate from high school in that same little community?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
The biggest class they'd had in years. There were 12 seniors.
I was going to ask you how big. 12. And did you like school? Did you like your classes?
I did, and it was too easy for me.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was talk to the lowest common denominator.
Sure, sure. Well, now, after you graduated from high school, what did you do?
Went to college.
Where?
It was in Massachusetts State College. Mm-hmm. And it just gotten a new name, having been the Mass Aggie.
Yes. And how far was that from your home?
That was 38, 40 miles.
Did you live at home?
Oh, no.
You lived on campus or near?
Yes, we had a car. We had a car at that time, but I think my mother drove me there to get me there, but I thumbed my way home and back to school.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Which is very, very successful, secure transportation.
I was gonna say, that's right. In those days, that was...
Yeah.
Well, now, did you live in a dorm? Did you have a roommate?
I lived in North College on the campus, four-story one with a Mrs. Adams guarding the gates at the...
Oh, dear.
My first roommate was Donald Donnelly, a good Catholic boy from another small town. And he was a good student. I was not. I was attracted by things that I had never seen.
I'm sure.
Before, yeah. It was. We got along all right. I went to church with him.
Did you?
Two or three times, trying to understand what was going on. I never did.
Well, I was just thinking about, you know, that was an opportunity for you for socialization and maybe after not being challenged in high school, thinking that the courses might appeal to you?
Well, the courses were just overwhelming to me.
Well, and there's something different about, you know, the method must have been such a different approach.
Oh, indeed.
Yeah, yeah, I had some of that myself. That was
But I do it. I was also attracted to such things as a pond nearby where I could go and skate during the winter and baseball.
Yes.
That I could, I enjoyed and was reasonably good at baseball. So I and actually had the first coaching that I ever had.
Sure.
And profited and enjoyed that so much that I flunked out of school.
Yeah. Yeah. And was that in the first year?
Yeah, I ended my freshman year.
And what did you do then?
I went home and laid low. But my mother managed through friends to arrange to get me into a prep school for a semester.
Uh-huh.
And then back again to finish my freshman year, which I did. And then as I got on to when I could major, I began to pick up, found things of interest.
Well, you know, some of that is certainly understandable, and And it wasn't that you weren't being educated. You were having some life lesson education, yeah, just a wider spectrum that makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
And so when did the learning bug bite you?
Well, actually, it was in probably the spring semester of my sophomore year when I took a course in elementary entomology.
Uh-huh.
Very charismatic, charming, knowledgeable professor.
Uh-huh.
The type that you knew was a professor. But he gave all this information so enthusiastically in an interesting manner, and it was something I could understand.
Yes.
And I, because of my farm life, I'd seen a lot of the things that he talked about, or I could understand them more easily than a city kid.
Yes. Yes.
And so that me. By the end of my sophomore year, my major was entomology.
Wonderful. Wonderful. Well, when did you get a glimmer about world events or something hit you about what was going on in Europe? Or were there any courses that talked about world events, or was there community talk about trouble and what that would mean to the U.S.?
I have no recall of anything that brought me in the international news sense. I can't recall any courses that brought out European history or world affairs, nothing of the sort.
So you were pretty involved in your education. And after you graduated, you had a degree in what?
A degree in entomology.
Uh-huh.
And then I became... Tried to be a salesman. It sounded like a really good idea. I'd seen these people dressed up and coming to the university and talking to people. And then I got some of the real world experience. I had a wonderful manager for New England, who took me under his wing and showed me what was going on and gave me some duties, so forth. But by the time I was trying to sell some insecticide to be used in June to a farmer who in February was up on the top of a tree doing his pruning, and I was talking to him from the ground, the snow up to my knees, I really lost enthusiasm. But regardless of that, I just don't have the sales inclination that people need in order to succeed. And fortunately, there was a good reason, a bad storm, and damage to fruit orchards that gave them good reason to tell me to go look somewhere else for work.
Yeah. That was a good move.
Yes.
Yes.
And that brought me to California.
Uh-huh.
Little near entomology, dealing in termite control.
Uh-huh.
That was interesting and challenging. as I got on, I became an inspector, and that expected me to make 4 or 5 calls a day at a place that needed to be treated, writing a report of it. But I was on my own making the inspection, which was arduous task in itself, and then making a diagram what was wrong and what needed to be done, and reporting that and estimating the cost of it. The majority of buildings in Southern California in that time in the late 30s had problems. And when they changed hands, the buyers wanted to be sure it was not
infested. Sure, yeah. How long were you there?
Well, I went out on the end of 38. And I was there until I went in the service in 42.
And were you drafted?
I was. Mm-hmm. I had tried to get a commission as an entomologist. And lacked the Navy's requirement for 2 years practical experience in the South Pacific. And not many humans
I was going to say
had that in those days.
Wonder if that's why it was written that way. So you entered as a...
So I was drafted.
Okay. Yeah. And where did you enter the service? Where were you inducted?
Fort MacArthur in the Long Beach, San Pedro area.
And so you were a beginning rank private?
I sure was. Because the college that I'd been to was a land-grant school and had required ROTC.
Yes.
I had 2 years of cavalry experience.
Oh, did you?
Which took me to Fort Riley, the cavalry school.
Yes.
The year that they stopped having horses.
I was just going to ask you that because I've got one other interview where they said, yeah, cavalry, no horses.
Yeah.
Well, what was that experience then?
It was a good learning experience. It was the doing what you were told and
the discipline and the
Comparing yourself to others.
Sure.
I did pretty well, and maybe my IQs and college degree gave me advantage, but at any rate, from there, I eventually went to ROTC, OCS rather. And,
yes.
In the options at the time were infantry and engineering. I took engineering.
Good man.
Call me what you will.
Oh, yeah.
I'm here to tell you about it.
Yeah, yeah.
Lots of second lieutenants in infantry never got back.
That's for sure. That's for sure. Well, now, when you were discharged from the service, I'm skipping a stage here. What was your rank? What was your highest rank that you achieved?
Captain.
That
was before I went into the reserve.
Yes.
I got one promotion during the reserve.
Did you? Did you stay in the reserves for a while?
I stayed in. It was a long time before they ever got caught up with me because I left the Los Angeles and came back to Massachusetts and transferring around. They never really got organized, and the university had this research and development group, which was a wonderful organization of primarily university and grad students, maybe
Well, can we go to the part that I just loved reading about now, when you were assigned to go to Europe and what your job was? I loved reading about that.
Well, as I say, I did get my commission in the engineers, and it was, and then I got assigned to an amphibian brigade based primarily on Cape Cod. But then in the wintertime, we came down to Florida for more training of the sort. But that organization didn't have a good slot to fit in the war, so they broke it up, and my fate was to be company commander of a small in harbor craft. Mm-hmm. Briefly, I was had a large company, which was terrible, and probably intended to operate in a large port like Cherbourg or Rouen. I lost my train of thought there.
We were talking about the Cape Cod.
Okay, so I had an opportunity to get a small boat unit, which is the 334th Harbor Craft Company. And it was in the Transportation Corps. Mm-hmm. And as I gradually learned, it's an unusual situation, because that company of myself and almost 20 officers and about 140 enlisted men was a whole unit. Mm-hmm. And got orders that came from somewhere that this unit is to be there at such a time. It was not going through battalion or regimental system. It was an independent company in that sense.
Right.
And when we I was a small boat unit commander, and the description of that didn't fit any of my talent or experience.
Yeah, I was going to ask you.
And so it may be that describes what you're supposed to try to be. And out of the 140 or so people that I had, there were not more than a large handful who had any boating experience at all. A fisherman from New England, one from Texas, a deckhand from on a Mississippi or Missouri River tug.
Incredible.
A dentist who was a Sunday sailor, and mm-hmm. a couple of other Sunday sailors. And
That was it.
And then I could break those up into an appropriate number of units with some degree of leadership or experience.
Yeah.
But when you assign people like that, we did find one man who could operate a floating crane, which we had, For the most part, we needed tug operators because we had a dozen or so tugs.
So there was no instruction and...
No.
It's real learn by doing.
Exactly.
Not even on the job training because there's no one there training you.
That's right. It was, this is a job to do and here's what you got to do it with.
And so you had people out on the water saying to themselves, let's try this, and what does this do?
Yeah, and it's good that they had some training time in Liverpool,
uh-huh,
which gave them an opportunity to learn something about the boats that they got.
Yeah.
But then they got different boats when they got to Europe.
Amazing.
Such fascinating stories of the adaptability and of American youth to do what has to be done.
To be willing to.
We had a country boy with a lot of pride that he. I think I made him staff sergeant, and his job was to take care of the 50-foot speedboat, which would be a Sunday special boat in the States.
Uh-huh.
And that was there only to take brass for tours or pleasure trips, whatever. Case was. But that boy kept that boat in ship shape, learned how to deal.
To do things.
Deal with it. This being a boat company.
Sure.
With all metal, virtually all metal boats, had two ship's carpenters. Well, it was a cold winter in 1944, and somebody at Schaefer headquarters saw that we could have good plywood, marine quality plywood. And it was decided that that would be useful to enclose the closed jeeps. And so a couple of generals in Paris had the makings for an enclosed jeep
to ride in.
And I look at some enclosed jeeps that I see running around nowadays. Origin of that style.
Isn't that amazing? Well, when you look back and you talk about the willingness of American youth, I also have to think, how did you as the commanding officer, assess who you had and who had what strengths, including yourself, and say, how can we best do this in kind of a difficult, at best, situation?
That's something to wonder about, isn't it?
You weren't... Now, how old were you? Were you older than them?
Maybe a few years. I was 29, probably had my 30th birthday in France.
So you had some life experience on them.
Yes. Yep.
But for the job you were supposed to do.
But I just had the rank.
Yeah.
In in several cases, I was no better qualified than several others, but I was the person that had that.
But I'm thinking in retrospect how between your intellect and your assessment of their human capabilities or your I have this sense that, you know, your rank didn't exactly go to your head, that you could approach them as equals and say, what do we have to do here? That you had a lot of respect from the people you were with. Do you think that's true?
Well, it's quite likely. I just have a hard time sorting out how things happen.
How it all got done.
Yeah. Well, there's... I'm astounded at the fact, as I've recounted, that I had the first people that got to Southampton from my company, a warrant officer he was not a forceful person, but he and a dozen servicemen were assigned to boats they'd never seen on the 3rd of June. And only because there was a delay because of the weather.
Yes, yes.
They didn't go until the 5th of June.
Right.
And they went with the British, a British engineering organization that I never saw anybody from that organization. It was just Chafe headquarters would say, this group of people takes this number of boats and go
here,
there. And I went into Paris when orders came.
Yeah.
Or first to London. In fact, I went, I had a set of orders from France to take me to London to headquarters. And those orders were written so broadly. I could have said, when the next transcontinental flight goes.
Goes, I will.
This'll work.
Yeah.
But I didn't use it. But no, I went from France to London and got some more orders. And well, that was the occasion. Well, it was we were in England. The story has to do with Chafe headquarters telling me to get my company to, gave me a direct order, get your company into Southampton by 3 June.
Yeah.
This was something like 28 May.
Was it?
Something like that.
Yeah.
And I went to the transportation to get the orders.
Yeah.
They couldn't do it. It's not possible.
Yeah.
But they had the number that they needed to man those boats to go with the British. So I got an order for one officer and some number of servicemen.
Yes.
Enlisted men. And there was no recourse. I had no place to turn, so I just used my ingenuity and made copies and sent the boys off, and they got there. They went, took the trains when they found a space.
Oh my gosh.
What
do you remember how you felt at the time, or was it scary or frustrating?
It was. It was bewildering.
Yeah.
Because there was almost a fury of activity.
Of course.
At that time, all those men that went out on the got their boats on the 3rd of June. They had to have their equipment then.
Yes.
We got ours later. Later. Like clothing and all.
Because you're transporting support equipment and supplies.
Yeah, but somebody was ranging for to be there and had in other words, we were part of a plan that somebody had pretty well, amazingly well organized.
But you didn't know the plan.
I was only getting my little
Your
piece.
Little segment.
Yeah.
But bewildering is probably a good descriptive word.
I think it's accurate.
And in the Army, you do as you're told, and you...
Yeah,
you get orders to do this, and you do it.
You don't think whether you want to do it or whether it's the right thing to do. You just do it.
Yeah. Well, let's put on the recording a little bit about what your regular duties were when you were based over there, and you had boats going, supply boats going from the port and carrying supplies in closer to the lines. Your watercraft.
At the end of July, the 24th, something like that. We got established, we got some boats there, and we got established a headquarters in the town of Assigny-sur-Mer in Normandy.
How do you spell that?
Assigny-sur-Mer.
Okay. That'll save the transcriptionist some
yes.
big time.
And we... usually abbreviated it simply Assigny.
Uh-huh. Sure.
But at that time, all supplies to the front came to ships that were anchored offshore.
Right.
And transferred into lighters that came ashore or ducks.
Yeah.
And brought them ashore, and then they were transferred again.
Mm-hmm.
At Assigny, there was a little town that had built a quay right up to the coastal highway that went through their town,
mm-hmm.
but it permitted them to bring coastal ships in and tie them up in the town center, as it were. Now, in wartime, that was the first place inland that the transfer could be made
uh-huh.
from ship to vehicle.
Right.
And that was tremendously important.
Oh, yes.
So our tugs helped the freighter come in and tie up
mm-hmm.
at high tide. Then because there was a 12 to 16 foot tide there, when the water went down, the boat was resting on
the bottom.
On the bottom and tied to the quay.
I see. Was it your job with the crane to unload those, or did that happen later on?
I don't know that it ever had any use until we got to Rouen.
I see.
But the activity at Assini in getting the boats in and unloaded, the unloading part was done by labor gangs.
I see.
But just realize that those jerry cans were going to be emptied in the tanks, which were on the front line.
Mm-hmm.
It was quite stimulating to think that that happening.
Yeah.
So we watched them work and was important to work with the tides and the boats and get everything going. But in addition, all around the Cotentin Peninsula, there are similar little ports, and not so busy because they were not in good position.
Yeah.
But yet I had tugboats, or in one case a fireboat, because that's what the assignment was, working those little ports. And I had occasion to go around and
say
hello to Eaton, all right, you're getting your rations and so forth.
It's just, and this is a part I'd never heard. Now, yours is a brand new responsibility that is another part of the whole scene.
Well, it's what's unique about this sort of company that it is attached administratively to a port. The port is a big unit to manage the whole port area. But the orders to do something and the allotment of equipment comes from way up there.
Yeah.
And I don't have anybody to report to, really.
Yeah.
And I'm told what to do, and I don't know what happens if I don't get it done. But
when you think about what a crucial role your company had.
It was an extremely important role for a number of days until I think they got a fuel line installed before the breakthrough at San Lo.
Yes.
But until that time,
you were in.
This was a very important source of.
Well, and I can't believe that it wasn't continually important. You know, maybe not the only one, but you know.
When the fuel line was going, I think they stopped sending fuel, but they sent other supplies.
Yeah.
And we were there when Patton was running his way through France and would threaten to stop until those rolls of newsprint got converted into his stars and stripes for his people. And it kind of put pressure on people to get it there. And they don't understand whether the tides permit the boat to get up there or not.
Yeah, that'd probably be considered some kind of back talk, wouldn't it?
Yes.
Don't give me excuses.
Yep.
Get it done.
Yep.
Were you or your men ever under fire?
Not directly, no. No. The biggest fright we had was in Southampton.
Mm-hmm.
We got there from the 3rd of June on, and the buzz bombs didn't make it into the to affect the damage the ships in the harbor. The loaded ships had already left, but these bombs were coming into the area, and I can't put this in a sequence, but I do remember that in a parade field there was a trench big enough for essentially the whole company to run in there and sit down on benches, so you were below ground level.
Yeah.
So that if something burst on 100 yards to the left and came across, you'd be protected.
Yeah.
You just hope that the buzz bomb wouldn't come down in the trench.
Direct. Mm-hmm. Have you ever returned to any of that part of the world?
My wife and I went back there in 1984, 40 years afterwards. And we found the dairy barn that had been my company headquarters in the village of Assini.
Did you?
And things had changed a lot, but you could see that that was the one. And learned that the town is famous for its mussels.
Oh.
Shellfish.
Yes.
And I recall seeing a recent National Geographic, I think, with pictures of sacks of mussels growing in the tidal area. So they're in the water according to the tide. One of my sons found that on the town and did have a good plate of mussels.
Did you keep up with any of the people in your company?
No. Partly because I left the company.
That's right.
To seek better and brighter days or at least a promotion.
Yes.
And they stayed in Rouen for a while and then were moved up to the Danube, I think.
Uh-huh, yes.
And I think they were still there after I was separated.
When I was thinking about all of the logistics that you were managing and your people were managing, what kinds of supplies and things were coming in and that you were transferring? It was probably a little of everything, wasn't it? Or did you ever, was it always things, and was it ever personnel or ever prisoners or?
We did not handle any, but I certainly have sharp memories of almost cattle trucks with with prisoners standing cheek by jowl in the trucks taking them to ship to go to the States as prisoners.
Yeah. And these were Germans?
Germans, yes.
Mm-hmm. What about injured soldiers? Did you see any wounded being?
I did not.
So when you went for a promotion and you transferred, where did you go then?
Well, I was transferred into the 11th Port, which is a big organization, a lot of officers. But within a few weeks of the time of that move, the port was sent back to the States for rest and regrouping. With the expectation that it would go on to Japan, because it had been the first organization in France and likely to be first organization. But I had a skin disease that caused me to be in the hospital for a week after I got to Boston.
Yeah.
And then I still had the month of leave coming to me, but I got to join the port a month or a week after they had gotten together and started organizing. So my military life from that point on was just one confusion and no learning contacts. I got so little left from that time.
Yeah. And you were discharged when?
Day after Christmas, 1946.
Merry Christmas.
Yes.
And when you were discharged, where did you go? Did you go home?
Well, I was discharged from Camp Lauché, which is in the New Orleans area. And I decided that since I had been working in California when I went in the service, that probably was worth looking at. So I talked to my wife about it, and she agreed. And so I went to Los Angeles and got a job, and then came back and spent time with her. And
I was going to say, when and where did you meet Hazel?
Let's take a break.
Fair enough. Okay. Let's go back, and I was asking you about where and when you met Hazel.
Well, that's an interesting story in itself. In 1934-35, I was working many jobs to get through school, and one was being running the dishwashing machine at cafeteria where I worked for my food.
Oh, yes.
And that was also the place, it was the college, only feeding place of the college. And so when they housed a weekly summer encampment for the 4-H youth of the of the state, that's where they ate. And there was this very attractive blonde that sat a place at a table where she could see me. And I couldn't tell whether it was just she flashed her eyes at everybody or whether she were flashing at me, but I took the latter and sent her a note. And we before the week was over, we had some time together and identified who we were and what our families were mm-hmm. like and so forth. So amazingly, in many aspects, that before the summer was over, her parents dropped her off at my home to spend a couple of days, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And arrangements had been made between parents.
Is that right?
To permit this and to make her parents know that there was suitable accommodations for each
yes.
of us that
yes.
my mother could monitor.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
But I have very nice photographs of Hazel at my home, and so this would be, say, at the end of 1935.
Had you had a girlfriend before?
Several.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then the year that I tried to be a salesman, I was working out of Worcester.
Mm-hmm.
And I could drive into Boston and pick her up when she left school.
Mm-hmm.
But I later learned that I had to arrange that according to her schedule so that she only had one of us at a time. And so we had a great bonding on the night of September 23rd, I'll say something like that, 1938, the night that a really big hurricane hit New England.
Mm-hmm.
And I picked her up at school and had been listening on my car radio to the weather reports.
Yeah.
And heard about them tying up boats in Gloucester. And that must be an interesting thing to watch. So when I picked her up, we decided that's what we'd go do. And we did that for a while, and then we decided to go up the coast and go to the Howard Johnson, and I think just on the edge of New Hampshire. And we had our dinner there. And before we got through, the electricity went off because the water was lapping on the underside of the restaurant. We were not paying attention to such things. Well, I don't remember the details, but say I had only a $5 bill to pay for dinner, and they couldn't make change.
Right.
Electricity was gone, but she had the $2.07 or whatever it was to get the rest for our dinners. And then we went on and sort of cut around in the country, and it was some scary times.
Yes.
I can remember particularly driving on a street or country road and wanting to go ahead, but was watching a tree that was wavering back and forth in the wind. So I timed myself so that the tree went away from the road
really?
And scooted on through. And it was a series of events like that sort of brought us closer together.
I would say so.
And then I got her home.
Yeah.
Finally, but it was fairly late, and her parents were concerned about us.
Yes.
But they didn't know much because the electricity was gone.
Yeah.
There, and they couldn't have any radio, so they came out and
listened to
the car radio
yeah.
with us. But that was probably the big bonding
yeah.
the affair. We had, yeah. had the emotional connection.
Sure, sure.
And from then on, I went to California and was there for a while, and mm-hmm. we had occasional correspondence. And I went with two girls that I can think of in California without getting very much involved with them. A couple of interesting stories there that are not relevant here. Then when the Army commissioned me, they sent me to Fort Devens for first set of training, and that's in Massachusetts, a short trip to Boston. Mm-hmm. And I immediately called and made arrangements with her to she would meet me at such and such a train at North Station. Well, she did, and she was dressed with a hat and gloves. Now that sounds strange.
No.
In these days, but it carried a message in those days. Uh-huh. So we that would have been maybe middle or end of January in 43.
Yeah.
And I spent many a night on the milk train. I would get into Boston. I would meet her someplace. Then she'd put me on the 2 o'clock, the last subway into the city, and I'd take the milk train back to get in the. If the bus was on time, I'd be on time for reveille.
Sounds like true love to me.
It was, but at any rate, in May of that year, we got married.
Uh huh.
And one of my great pieces of luck at the time was that the officers, for some reason, didn't want to give me a wedding gift. They gave me a promotion. Well, numbers count. And so I was a first lieutenant before almost all second lieutenants had a chance at it. And that meant that I was in position to get the company less than a year later.
Yeah.
So we got married, lived in Hyannis in an apartment for a while, and then we got moved to Carrabelle, and it took me some time to get a fishing shack, really, for us to live in, mm-hmm. because it was the first place we lived in as a house. I picked her up at dusk and carried her through the door and set her down on the floor. Cockroaches spread. We survived that, and then when I was ticketed for overseas, she went home and stayed.
Yeah. And you started your family.
We had, I think, 2 weekends in New York before I left.
Uh-huh.
And she got pregnant one of those weekends, uh-huh. apparently.
Mm-hmm.
Which she wanted a baby very. It was not a really good thing to do. But I didn't see a lot of hazard in my future. If we'd gone to Japan, been something else.
And your first child was?
Phil Jr.
Phil Jr.
Born December 8th. That worked out about right.
And you had how many children altogether?
Altogether, three.
Three. And all have done very well for themselves.
All have had professional careers. The boys are both retired and travel a great deal. They each have two houses.
Where do they live?
Well, Phil Jr. lives, he has a home in Haverford, Pennsylvania, where he was English department at the Episcopal Academy, prep school. And his wife had her Bryn Mawr investment. She was a Bryn Mawr graduate. The younger, and their second home, they call it their house, is in Williamstown, Massachusetts, where their daughter went to school, and they just liked it, and now they spend a lot of money in the house up there, and just drive up there for overnight just to make sure the contractor gets the right color on something when they redo the bathroom. And the younger boy lives in Winnetka, and his second home is in Boulder, Colorado.
And your daughter?
She has one home, two sons, in San Diego. The older boy is a freshman at UCLA, and the
my goodness,
the younger one is in school in San Diego.
Well, do you get to see your family very often?
They come here and visit me.
Good.
I don't go anywhere.
You're supposed to do that. You're supposed to say, here I am in Florida. Come on down.
They know. But she and her husband and her two kids, ever since there have been two kids and before there were two kids, have come here at Christmas time every year.
That is wonderful.
And that's gotten a big, pretty big expense.
It's worth it.
Well,
I'm sure they.
I think they must feel it because they keep on doing it.
Yes.
And all three of them have to go to the Hilton. That's only place.
Sure.
Good enough.
Well, now, when you left the service, what did you do for your first job?
I went back, took another job in termite control, and my license was still good, and I was surprised at how much money I was paid when it was announced to me, but then I realized how little it was compared to the cost of things. But at any rate, I got to the point where I've got to get in business or find something else to do.
Yeah.
We went and looked around Santa Barbara. I've got a friend who had his business there, he's a millionaire several times over. But I have no regrets at deciding that's not for me and went back to Massachusetts. And shortly got in a graduate school with a with a very nice fellowship. And we had a wonderful 3 or 4 years. The second boy had come along by then.
Did you, when you look back on your service, do you think it changed you? Do you think you had any values conflicts with what you were doing? Your job as opposed to how you were raised as a person?
No, I don't think there was any values conflict. But surely my experience in the military had a great deal of shaping effect on me. I got used to the position of being in authority, which in a way is saying I matured a great deal because of the military experience.
Mm-hmm. I understand.
And I found that soon after I got into graduate school. And the faculty respected me as an equal because of what I had done.
And how you present yourself. I mean, it gives you a sense that you can do things.
Yes, yes. And I was in a seminar program.
And, yeah.
And early on, I gave a talk on termites and termite control.
Yeah.
That was given in Massachusetts where people didn't even know there were termites. And big deal. Just what was common knowledge to me.
Yes.
Earlier.
Yes.
But seeing how that worked, and then when I got into the reserve group, and we would, I guess it was monthly, have a meeting which required us to be in uniform,
and sure.
review what was going on. Well, because I had research going on, I would in uniform go through the department or the library,
yeah,
and or the laboratory, and pretty impressive to,
yes,
to people,
yes,
that hadn't,
that didn't know that part.
Yeah.
And so you got your graduate degree, and with the idea that you would do what with it?
I would get a research job. In fact, for a few months, I had a laboratory by the corporation funding it, but it was a laboratory that I could have probably operated for other purposes.
Yeah.
But about that time, a job came open in the National Pest Control Association. And I thought I had worked on both coasts. I had a doctorate. I had some background from my military experience, and I thought I ought to have that job, and I got it.
Right.
And so that accounted for the rest of my mm-hmm. my professional life.
What brought you to Gainesville and when?
Well, during the time I was in National Pest Control, I came to the USDA laboratory down just off Archer Road.
Uh-huh.
And exchanged information with them. So I'd been here.
Uh-huh.
And then Hazel and I looked around the Orlando area. Didn't find anything real appealing, and she had been here with me sometimes, and we came back and looked again and decided this is probably the best we're going to do. We had looked in a couple of places up north.
And was this in consideration of retirement? When was this?
Oh, yes, this was indeed.
Okay.
It was well, we were still living in Amherst.
Uh-huh.
No, by that time we'd gotten down to New Jersey, and we had a home there that we were living in at the time I retired. And but when travel opportunities, we went look at down in Arizona. I can't think of the name now.
Mm-hmm.
And as I said, we looked around Orlando.
Uh-huh.
We liked this because it had some season, had the university, lively community, mm-hmm. and liberal. Found what we needed.
And did you buy a house here initially?
We initially bought a house and realized in about 6 months that it was a mistake.
Yeah.
Was able to sell it in the days of 17% interest.
Oh. Oh.
And use that money to build a house.
I see.
We build it a mile directly east of here.
I see.
And I became attached to the land and
and
built friendships.
Yeah. This is a nice community.
Yes.
Absolutely. Does your family know all about your war record and your experiences in any amount of detail?
Well, you've seen the 50-page summary that I made, and that came about because we were visiting the younger boy and eating in a restaurant in the Chicago area somewhere, and I think their son was maybe 5 years old or something like that, or maybe a little older. But somehow the topic of the war came up.
Yeah.
And my son said, I just don't know very much about your military experience. And so I started thinking about it and then started writing, and I had already written a couple hundred pages about my younger days.
Yeah. That's wonderful. And what was his reaction?
Well, I only gave him a general picture at that time. It wasn't very much, but then I wrote this up. And so that son and that grandson and the other and his siblings have copies.
But your other children don't?
No, the two boys and the daughter.
Yes, I see.
They all
have it.
Yeah.
I think that families are more and more interested, and I find, you know, more and more people are interested in asking questions of the elders in their family about, you know, what their early life was like, and did you have electricity, and, you know, when do you remember the first television or radio or whatever, and
people these days do not understand what it was like to see your first electric light, your first telephone.
Yes. Pretty amazing.
Yes.
Is it as magical as we think a memory card in our camera is?
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a better history lesson for, like, your grandchildren to hear firsthand stories than anything they'll ever read in a book.
I would like to turn you loose on my older son.
Okay, bring him on. I'm ready.
Odin has never said boo about his... He was in intelligence at Vietnam time, spent his whole time in Hawaii. But he probably was forsworn not to say something, but he...
Well, I often tell people, you know, that in these interviews, I don't know whether you call it low selling or whatever, but I kind of have a strong ethical sense about my responsibility as the interviewer. And this is an interview about what you're willing to share. This is not an interrogation. And I think that there are people who put up a lot of blocks and they think, oh, I've been asked a lot of personal questions, or I've been asked, you know, I don't think that's our job. And of course, many of the World War II veterans either can't go back to some of those experiences or won't. And I'm not there to chip away at that.
But it's important to have your questions, because I think the significance of my experience in war was how it developed me as a person.
Absolutely. And I see what... Everything you're saying is, and we've probably all had similar experiences that you say, I didn't choose this, but what a difference it made for me.
Mm-hmm.
Well, before I turn off the tape, and if you have other things that we want to add, we can certainly come back, and if there are things that you want to fill in, either now or after you see the draft, but officially... Please know that I thank you very much for your sharing and for your wisdom about your own life.
Well, it's been enjoyable, and I'm glad we got to do it, Anne.
Good.